Interesting for you. If not, I'm sorry. But the other talks later on in the schedule for the year look very interesting. So, as I said, my name is Sarah Gaunt. I work for a company called Emanate. We are actually based on site here in Sutton Bonington. We're in the main building upstairs, hidden away in a little office, and we've got some labs over in North Lab. And I can see a few familiar faces around the place. I'm going to talk to you and give you some background on what Emanate does, who we are, show you what we're going to do. Then I'm going to take you through a case study, just so that we demonstrate. Yes, we say we do all these wonderful things, but it's an actual demonstration of what we do and how we go through the processes. Then I'm going to talk about future development, future work that we're doing, and then sort of talk to you guys. You can ask me any questions, any discussion. So, who is Emanate? What do we do? We are a wholly owned subsidiary of the University of Nottingham. So the university is our only shareholder. Emanate was set up about 6 years ago with the idea of taking clever ideas from local schools in the university and taking them a little way along the value chain, adding some value to it, and then getting them out to big companies so that went into the real world so people can use them. So the main purpose of the company is to identify, develop, protect and exploit IP. Now, it says that it can come from the university. We can get sources of ideas from anywhere, so we don't have to get them from the university. The university has a lot of brilliant ideas and it's a good place to start, but we've also got our own R&D teams, which we bring ideas through. We've worked with other universities, we've worked with small local companies, big multinational companies, so the ideas can come from anywhere. We've got two specific market focuses. One is food and ingredients, which is the part that's based here at Sutton Bonington, and that's the area that I head up, which is what most of this talk will be about. We've also got an engineering powder and coating section, so they're looking at things like atomized powders and hydrogen storage, orthopedic implants and things like that. They're based over at University Park in the engineering school. Now, the idea of our bases is that we are close to the academics, close to people who are working in these particular fields, so that we can interact and we can start working with people. Now, why do we do what we do? Big multinational companies really want to stay ahead of the game, and they want clever ideas, and they want to have the next best product coming out into the market so that they can get that market share. They want to work with universities, they want to work with clever people. However, some of the problems that they have is that sometimes ideas coming out of universities or academic groups are too early stage for companies to invest in. So one of the ideas behind Emanate was to do some work and try to get these ideas up to a point where large companies can invest. Everyone's talking about open innovation at the minute, which is essentially large companies going out and finding someone else to do research and clever ideas for them. So we are set up as a company to do these steps. Now, the university is very good at coming up with good ideas, protecting them, but it's not in their core business to do the other things, to find test products, find its applications, make things on commercial scales and get out and sell things. And it shouldn't be in their remit to do that. They should be doing what they're doing. So we are set up to try and do that. And the way we do that is we've got some simple steps. I've written them down and they look quite simple. And I'm going to take a product through this and show you how we do this. So basically, Someone will come up with a clever idea, wherever that source can come from. They'll do, most likely, the academic or whoever's come up with the idea will do some initial lab trials. What is it? What's the benefit of it? Is there any application in the commercial world? And probably start the IP protection process, file a patent. Can we protect it in some other way? Do we have to file a patent? Then we can get involved. This is normally where universities sort of stop, and this is where we start. So we'll take a product in-house and we'll look at how it can be used commercially. We'll start making things at production scale, and that could be, depending on the product, that could be a range of different sizes. We'll sell a representative amount. It says a few cents here, but that, if it's a high-value product, that could be a lot less. One of the key things is to try and get repeat business, because that's one of the things that we've done in the past and is really good when you're negotiating a license deal. You've got customers who are repeatedly coming back and saying, yeah, it's not just you that says the product's good. This customer's saying, this product's really good. We want it. We want to keep buying it. And then you try and get that licensing deal. Now, as I said before, the university's very good at this. About 6 years ago, they identified that there was a gap in this section, and they started innovating to do this. The way we do this is we've got an internal product development process. And now, one of the key things about M&A is we're working towards a quality system, putting a quality system in place, which is ISO 9001. We're about to get our audit next week. So that we're doing things repeatedly, so that if all of us left tomorrow, there's still a business model there that we can come in, look at the processes and say, yeah, we can repeat that. And hopefully we can repeat that product after product after product. So we get this idea of generation coming from various places. We'll then look at a proposal formation. So we'll look at product description, business case, is there anybody interested in it? And what work do we have to do to sort of build into these and get to the next stage? At each of these stages, we'll have a stage gate where we can say, no, this is not going to work, yes, plow on, so that we don't get too far down the line and realise that we can't do something. We'll then start doing this, what we call fact-finding or concept development. So we'll do some more looking at the market, talking to people, assessing whether there's a product there. We'll look at the IP. Can we file it? Can we protect it somehow? We'll look at routes to market. So are we going to make something ourselves? Are we going to use a contract manufacturer? And we'll do some risk analysis as well. And then these sort of three stages can take 2 months, maybe not very long. This is where the fun starts. Here, so we take things in. We'll do some manufacturing. We'll look at some sort of lab scale manufacturing. We'll try and work out some costs. We'll do that against what the market's willing to pay for such a product. And we'll do some applications work. We'll send samples off to customers. We'll start some branding and marketing. We'll also start going out to. We're going to use a contract manufacturer. We'll go out and start talking to them, running some pilot scale batches, and we'll get some real costs and real ideas. These two stages tend to be run in parallel, so that when we get to the point where we know that we can make something, we can start selling it. And so we can do this quite quickly. So some of the reasons why we might stop a process once we've got in there is business case, nobody's interested. Sometimes there's too many conflicting patents that we either make it impossible for us to protect or means that we would be infringing somebody else's intellectual property if we went forward. One of the key things is if it's too expensive to manufacture or you can't manufacture it at scale. If it just doesn't work, that's another one. Or we can get it to work, but customers can't. They're not going to keep trying to get something to work for a long time. So, just a bit more now about M&A. So that's what we do and how we do it. These are some of the people that we've got. We're a small team. We've got about 10 members of staff, but we cover sort of a multidisciplinary range of people. So we've got some food science, we do some chemistry, people with a background in pharma, micro, a couple of the really interesting things is that we've got product development chef who'll do actual recipes that you'd get on a pilot line in a factory. That's where her background comes from, so we test recipes, we test ingredients in actual products. And then we've got expertise in sort of running and growing spin-outs and start-up companies. We've got a board which includes people from industry and people who've run big companies before, so they know their way around the food industry, and they're really helpful for contacts or knowing whether something's going to work or not. I've mentioned that we've got some facilities here. We've got some facilities over at University Park as well. So we're currently engaging with some people over in Sutton Bonington. We're always looking to collaborate with new people and talk to people. We've got various projects going on. So we've got a couple of TSB projects, one with Ian Fisk. We've got a project with David Gray. And we've got a couple of... we've had four MSc students in the summer, and we've got two PhD students that are just starting up now. So we're interacting with food science, with nutrition, and starting to get something to talk to academics and sort of getting ideas going back and forwards. So that's all nice in principle, but I want to talk to you about what we've actually done, and this is our biggest success to date. It's a product called Sodalo, and I'm going to take it through each of those 9 steps so you can see what we actually did at each stage. So, coming up with a novel idea. This was actually a product that was invented in-house in M&H by the R&D team. When we were first starting out in the food and ingredient space, the reduction of sodium, as it is today, was a really big issue. People were struggling to meet targets set by the Food Standards Agency, Department of Health. There were various different ways, looking at just reducing sodium by stealth, replacing it with other ingredients. But people were finding it difficult to reduce the levels. Consumers weren't desperately happy with salt being reduced. It was either affecting the taste or the functionality, or adding new ingredients that they didn't know what they were or why they were in their food. So the problem with having too much sodium is this cardiovascular disease. It really impacts that, and that is a huge problem in a lot of countries. One of the problems with taking salt out of food is that it's not just there for taste, but we've all got used to salty food and we all like the taste of salty food. It's also there for functionality and shelf life, so controlling microorganisms. There's a lot of government pressure to reduce salt at the minute, and there has been for a number of years. But there are many alternative solutions on the market. A lot of them sort of bring their own problems. So something like potassium chloride, it's got a sort of metallic taste, so you've got to then add taste maskers, which then reduces your ingredients list. You've got to look at the functionality. You can't just reduce salt in every food. You've got to think about the taste, because people are getting to the point where they'll pick up a reduced sodium packet and think, oh, that's good, that'll be good for my health. But if it doesn't taste good, you're not going to repeatedly buy it. So, we developed a product called Sodalo, which was it's a new crystalline form of normal salt, basically. We were at a conference, someone was giving a talk on reducing the particle size of sodium chloride. If you reduce the particle size, you get a tastier, higher impact salt flavour, and a better distribution within the food. One of the problems with doing that is you'll tend to get clumping, because the smaller the sodium chloride, the more water it'll absorb, and the more it'll clump. So the industry needs something to remain free-flowing. So that's kind of what we produced, and I'll talk about this within the initial lab trial. So what is it, what does it do? So this is table salt, and I'm not sure you can see desperately well, but the normal size of your table salt is sort of 300 to 500 microns. This is milled salt, so if you just mill the salt, you can get it down to sort of 5 to 10 micron, particles. But this is what happens. You'll get these big lumps of milled salt pretty much straight away. It's not a flowable product. You lose that impact of taste because you've not got the surface area anymore, and it actually ends up being larger than your table salt. So, this is sodalite. It's these are hollow spheres of sodium chloride. So these are the little crystals of sodium chloride. They're basically held together by, well, in this case it's gum arabic. So we've got carrier in there, which is gum arabic. It's produced by a standard spray drying process. But what it means is that they remain free flowing, and they're about 5 to 10 microns in size. They've remained free flowing for 2-3 years. We've got shelf life on the product now, which is something the industry is very interested in. So that was the initial lab trials. Then we started looking at patents. So we filed a patent on this, which covered the product and manufacturing process. We've gone through PCT with this, and we're now being examined in individual countries. I've got a meeting with the US patent examiner on Friday, so hopefully, if that goes well, we'll get it awarded in some countries. We've already been awarded it in New Zealand, but apparently they don't really read it. They just award it. So the next stage, after we'd protected it, was how can it be used commercially? And what are the benefits? What can we tell customers that this will offer you? So it gives you a greater flavour impact, and meaning you use less. It remains free-flowing, so no problems with deterioration. There's no contamination taste, so you don't have to add any taste maskers. You can keep ingredients down. It's salt, so you label it in your product as salt, sodium chloride. You're not actually adding something new. We did a lot of trials on this. We looked at all of these different food types. I'm only talk about two today, briefly. But it worked. It worked in a lot of cases, and it worked really where we didn't think it should. One of the limitations with this, though, we have found, is that it doesn't work for curing bacon. And it doesn't work if you put it in and you dissolve it. If you dissolve this product, it goes straight into saline solution, basically, and you've lost its functionality. So it needs to be a dry or a semi-dry product. One of the products that it did work well in that we didn't think it would is bread. So we've taken the salt down by half in bread here. And this has been repeated on a factory scale. We've got a very large consumer buying this for their bread at the minute. One of the reasons we didn't think this would work was we thought that it would dissolve straight away because it's quite a wet dough. But one of the ways that we found for getting around this was if you added it when you created a dough first and added it, it tended to work. It didn't dissolve. You got better distribution before it fully dissolved. And you can see that by some of these pictures. So this is the distribution of sodalite, which is quite the green dots are chlorine and red dots are sodium. So it's sort of distributed quite nicely. And then we've got this with normal salt. And you can sort of see it's not distributed as well. That's one of the key things that we think, the reason why we think it's working. We then got what's called a Spark Award from Biosciences KTN to work with Reese Heath College to put this into cheeses. So we did a long project, year-long project, looking at this in cheddar. They've got a big cheese production facility over in Cheshire. And they made some cheese containing normal salt and sodalite. We reduced the levels in both normal salt and of sodalite. And we left this to mature. We looked at various different things. One of the key things for cheese was the micro content, and would we still be able to control the microbiology. What we did find was that we could reduce sodium in all the cheeses, which is fine. And they all had similar values for protein, moisture, fat. Didn't affect what you were making. What did happen was when you reduced the amount of normal salt, your yeasts and molds increased. When you did that with soda low, the yeast and molds didn't increase. We did some trials, and soda low cheese seemed to have a similar taste when you reduced it to 1.5% soda low to the salt with 2%. So that was really a positive trial. And what we actually did with the results of this trial and some of the cheese that was made was we took this out to a large pizza manufacturer in the US, and we did some trials with them, and we basically made a pizza with, I think it was 25% less sodium. So we used this cheese, we made a dough with less sodium, and we made a tomato sauce with less sodium. And they started buying the product based on this. So this was a really key study. It was something that people didn't really think could be done. So we were just starting to collect data, and we've done that all along with lots of different applications. One of the things we found was that actually making soda low was, those balls was actually quite expensive. We got some really good results, but the industry was saying back to us, no, this is quite expensive, we're not sure we could justify buying this even with your sodium reduction. So one of the things we looked at was using a milled salt that would normally cake, but using the soda low 20, the little balls, as a flow agent. And that worked really well, and that allowed us to have a different blend, which actually works better in some applications than others, so topical applications. This blended product worked really well, so things like crisps and peanuts. We could also do bespoke blends for different food applications with different manufacturers, so that was quite an interesting thing to look at. You could just do that, you get a slightly different taste profile. So then the next thing we looked at was looking at production on a large scale. In-house, we could produce sort of hundreds of grams of soda low, but customers were coming back to us saying, it's a really interesting idea, but I need one ton to run it on my line, on my pilot line. So we then went out to a toll manufacturer. We spent a bit of time trying to find the right toll manufacturer, the right contract site to do this on, and we found some really good guys down in Somerset who were really helpful in that technology transfer of what we've done on a lab scale up to a pilot scale and then manufacturing scale. So we were producing batches of 10 tonnes, 20 tonnes at a time now, using just an ordinary spray drying route. That's one of the key things with this, is that it's not too difficult to scale up because it was quite a simple process. Then we looked at selling some product and getting repeat business. So one of the ways we did that was we looked at using distributors. So we distributed in the US and Australia. So we sent out 40 tons of this product to Australia, 20 tons to America. And we were starting to get sales out there and also getting sales in the UK, which were generated in-house by M&A. Along with samples that we gave out to people, we would give technical sales support. So we'd go out and work with people and try and work through their recipes. We also did a lot of editorials, trade shows, presentations, just trying to build up the interest in soda low. We got some repeat sales, and that's really important for when we went to the licensing stage. So Marks and Spencer's used this in their white bread, their So Healthy range. We've got a company in Ireland using it in pies, Dr. Urca use it in their frozen pizzas. And these are people coming back to us repeatedly, wanting an order every month, every 2 weeks. So then the next stage, and this is the fun bit, is getting someone to buy this product off you. So the way we generated interest from large companies was we demonstrated that we protected this product. We had a patent behind it, and they could go out into the market with something new that was defensible. We also demonstrated applications. We had a lot of applications work. We could say, try it in this, don't try it in this, so that we weren't getting negative feedback from customers. We were already at a stage where we could manufacture at scale. We had initial initial sales, we had repeat sales. So then we essentially had a beauty parade. We had a number of companies who were really interested in the product, and they came in and they discussed it with us, and they spoke to some of our customers, and they spoke to people who'd used the product, and they did some due diligence, looked at the product themselves, and in the end we went with a deal with Tate & Lyle, and we signed that last year in November, before now actually, in November 2011, and that was a worldwide exclusive license. So Tate & Lyle now make this product, they manufacture it, they do all the applications work, they do all the sales and marketing, and they do all the customer interaction, which is quite nice for us not to have to do that anymore, but we've done that product now. We recently launched it in Las Vegas and Frankfurt in worldwide launches, and in Frankfurt it won the most innovative new ingredient. So, that's Sodalo, and that's how we would take any product, motor product, through that process from an initial idea to a licensing deal, potentially. Future development. I'm just going to give you a bit of a flavour on some of the other work we're looking at, and maybe it'll spark some interest, maybe you'll have some ideas of your own. One of the things that we got from industry when we were talking about Sodalo was it's great reducing sodium chloride, but a lot of my sodium is coming from sodium bicarbonate, certainly in baked products. So we naively thought, oh, we can do the same thing that we've done with sodium chloride, with sodium bicarbonate. It was a lot more tricky than that, but we did manage to produce this nice spherical ball of sodium bicarbonate, which again is a hollow structure, again produced by spray drying. Smaller size than your average sodium bicarbonate, but it shows increased activity, increased carbon dioxide yield. When you get the right balance between sodium bicarbonate and an acid in a baking powder, you can get quite a lot more. So these two have the same amount of sodium, quite a bit more carbon dioxide being released. And we see that in some of our applications work. We started out by looking at cakes, because I like to eat cakes, so any taste trials would be fun. So we started looking at cakes. We knew that the sodium bicarbonate in cakes, because a lot of people wanted to reduce the sodium in cakes. And we managed to get a 40% reduction. And these are actually some of the images that we went through on our way to getting that 40% reduction. So this is with a 25% reduction, and we've looked at different acids mixed with sodium bicarbonate here, and we're seeing that massive increase in gas. And this is, we've now got a product that looks very similar to this and tastes very similar to this with 40% less sodium. But it's quite interesting seeing the stages that you go through. And we've looked at this product in cakes, scones, donuts, biscuits, soda bread. We're starting to work through a number of things, and we're looking to license this product before long. So we've got the manufacturing on this product. We've got some samples out with customers. We're looking to market this now. So another product is one that we're working with Tim Foster in Food Science on to try and commercialise, which is something we're calling Fixate. It's an ingredient that can go in food, which when it gets in your stomach, it'll swell and it'll gel, and it sort of sits there and slowly breaks down in 4 hours. Now the idea behind this is that it will make you feel full, and the aim is to reduce the calories that you consume at your next meal. We're also looking to sort of moderate long-term behavioural change, so we can start getting towards some kind of weight loss product. We've done some early lab work on this. We've just completed a human tolerability study which showed some really, really good results. And we're just about to start a full human trial over at QMC in February. So we're looking at testing whether a combination of a drink and a bar or a mid-morning snack will reduce the calories that you consume. And the aim of this is to get an EFSA-approved claim on satiety. So that's quite an exciting project, but until we get sort of the results of those trials, we've got everything else sort of planned out. We know that we can manufacture this, we know that we can make it, we know the application for it, just whether these trials and these human trials work. So just a few of the other projects that we've got going on. We've got a number of TSB-funded projects looking at a variety of different areas. So we've got some looking at fermented grains for fish food, one working with Ian Fisk in food science on the development of a tracer device to look at the efficacy of probiotics. We've got a project looking at chicken feed and whether we can, our ingredients in chicken feed can reduce Campylobacter in poultry. And one of the things that the engineering side is working on is hydrogen storage. We've also got a number of PhD students working, so we've got one looking at an excipient based on something called natokinase, and that's over in the School of Pharmacy. We're just about to start a PhD looking at oil bodies from algal sources over here, and we've got another PhD who's working on the 6-8 project. So just to put that back up, that's what we're about, that's what we can do. If there's anything that sort of sparks any interest, if you've got any ideas or want to know more, please contact us, get in touch, ask any simple questions, and you can ask questions now if you like.
Thank you very much, Sarah. Fascinating stuff, lots of different steps to get from a brainy idea through to a market that somebody like Tate and Lyle's going to take on.
Yeah. It does increase the value of the product, though.
Yeah.
So when you're asking for people to put into fund a project right at the early onset, being able to license a product, there's a massive difference in the sort of value proposition you've got there. Mm.
So can I ask a question while everybody's thinking?
Yep.
The one about sodium bicarbonate sounds very similar to soda low that you described.
Yep.
So will you naturally go to Tate and Lyle and say, do you want to go with this product as well? Or will they come back to you and say, look, actually, that's so similar to this product that there are some IP issues that we need to deal with?
Yeah, I mean, we filed a separate patent, so there isn't any IP issues, so we're aware of that. We've kept Tate and Lyle sort of in the loop with all the work that we've been doing. Definitely go down the licensing route with them. We'll probably open it up to other people, but it is a possibility.
Okay. Question?
Well, the main limitation with it's mainly with spray drying that the limitation is. The product that we're making is probably on the smallest scale that you can do industrially with spray drying. We tend to lose a lot of the real fine product out through the exhaust. So that's really the only limitation. If we could find another way of doing this and getting nano-sized particles, then anything's possible, I think. Yeah, you could do that. And I think for the case that we've got, we were looking for something that was fairly industry standard, so it didn't add a lot of cost. Something like that, I think you'd have to have quite a high value product to be able to store something new in a manufacturing facility. Yes, I think that there is an argument for that. I think that the amount of salt that we take in as a country, and certainly in the developing world, we've got a massive amount to go to get to that stage. Yeah. you need 8 grams a day. I think we're taking in 8 grams a day. I think the World Health Organization, yeah, I think the World Health Organization would like us to reduce it to 4 grams a day. And I think it's below that that you then start getting some of those issues. But I think we've got a long way before we'll start hitting some of those issues.
Sounds like a discussion you should have over some crisps.
Yes.
Any other questions for Sarah?
Yeah. Yeah, it is a more expensive product. They are starting, I think, manufacturers are starting to bring in sodium reduction, and they're starting to use it across ranges, and they're starting to try not to tell us that they're reducing sodium, because they're finding if they're putting sodium on labels, people are not buying them. They've literally started off with the healthy range because they know they can get a premium for that. When we were selling that to them, it was right towards the point where we were licensing. So I don't now know whether it's in all the range. It could well be. Neymar could have taken that up.
And is it available as a table product?
It's only in food at the minute. Tate and Lyle are talking to people about putting it into a tabletop product. Oh yes, sorry, yes. Yes it is. It's intellectual property, so it's patents. I guess you can protect it another way, so trade secrets don't know how, but you don't tell anyone.
I'll take a question here and then that one there. Sorry.
You know your muffins? Yes.
They all
sell up the same amount? Yep, same amount, same weight.
So you get a much bigger muffin.
Yes. Well, exactly, yeah. Yep, if we were selling muffins.
Yeah, another question.
I was just wondering, Phil, if one was going to make a premium product out of this, or
would you just say that it's going to be consistent? The way we always pitched Solo was against other sodium reduction products, opposed to against salt. We're never going to be able to match the price of salt because it's so cheap. So it is a premium product in that sense because you're getting the sodium reduction, but it is a lot more expensive. So you probably wouldn't put it in your value spread because you'd add far too much cost onto it.
So you're relying on the manufacturing process being
We are, yeah, and the fact that people are, or manufacturers, have got so much pressure from the regulators to reduce sodium. I think if that pressure wasn't there, this product there wouldn't be a market for it. It's too expensive.
So following up from that, Sarah, have you or Tatum, or yourself, or Tate and Lyle, actually gone to the regulators and said, this is our product, this is what it can do?
We have, yeah, and when we were developing this project, I actually went out to Portugal to the FSA to go to a sodium reduction seminar on this project, on this product. They can't recommend it and they can't be looking to favour anything, but they were trying to get the message out to people.
Because often, if I was a regulator, I could see a situation where I would have something that I'd want to implement, and then industry would come to me and say, oh, we can't do that, it's too difficult. So if you go about it the other way, it obviously offers opportunities to put the regulation in place, which creates a market for products.
Yes, and I think that's what's going on at the minute. The manufacturers are saying we can't reduce sodium any further. The regulators sort of know that we've got products and they're all doing it, so they're fighting against each other at the minute, which is quite interesting to watch.
Okay. Any other questions for Sarah?
Yeah? I've been looking at that for about 2 years and not at the minute. If anyone can. I know. We've been looking at it and it caramelises and it breaks spray dryers, I found. But yeah, it's something that I'm continuing to look at. So if anyone's got any really good ideas in that field, let me know.
Any other questions? Okay, well, I'm assuming that nobody had any fixate for breakfast, so therefore you're probably ready for a sandwich and a salty crisp. But in the meantime, if we could thank Sarah once again. Sandwiches. As you know, we do these talks monthly, but at the moment our February speaker has had to postpone his talk, so the one plan on the 21st of February is currently not going to happen. Of course, we've got the one in place in February, but it may be that we don't, and in which case we would then jump straight to the 22nd of March rather than the one in February, but we will try and keep posted. So there was going to be one in February without here, I'm sad to say, but then one in March will be about food allergies and